Hello and welcome to Bird & Bird's Aviation and Defence Pioneer podcast series on sustainability. I'm speaking to leading players across the entire aviation and defence sector who are playing a role in sustainability. My name is Paul Briggs, a consultant in our aviation and defence group based at our London office. Today, I'm delighted to be speaking to Austin Willis, Chief Executive of Willis Lease, for what I have no doubt will be another fascinating discussion. Austin, please just tell us a little bit about yourself, and then can you just home in on how long have you been interested in sustainability, or is this a more recent development for you?
Thanks, Paul, and thanks for having me on today. I think this is an exciting topic, and I'm looking forward to engage on it. In terms of, you know, how long have I been interested in sustainability? It's sort of a tricky question, but, you know, I grew up in San Francisco, sort of a throwback to the old hippie days when I was there in the 80s. And I spent my weekends with my dad out in the woods in our VW Love Bus. I grew up around nature and was always very aware of it and very aware of conservation. You know, that being said, I don't think it really resonated with me until more recently. So it's really been a more recent development when I kind of look into the future and think to myself, you know, where is our industry going to be in the next 10, 20 years? And how can we participate in it? And for me, aviation has always been a love, both flying airplanes myself. I'm just a recreational pilot, but also just what aviation brings to the world socially, the empathy and understanding you get from spending time with different cultures in different parts of the world. So I've got an interest in ensuring that aviation still remains as relevant as it is today in the future. And I think sustainability is going to play a really big role in that.
I couldn't agree more. I totally get that. And I see you're also bringing in the broader environmental and social issues as well as and governance issues as well as just sustainability. Can you tell me just a little bit about Willis Lease Finance Corporation? And I know that you're a listed company, so you have to be quite careful about what you say, but can you tell me a little bit about the group strategy and particularly what is your focus on innovation?
Sure. So Willis Lease, just to kind of go back a little bit and give you a bit of history in the 1,000-foot view, the company was founded by my dad in the early 80s, initially a jet engine lessor. My dad went and bought his first engine, mortgaged the house, and put it on lease to a maintenance repair and overhaul facility, and then found that there was a market for that and continued to do so, raised a little bit of money, went public in 1996 with a secondary offering in 98. Today, I think we're $2.5 billion in assets owned, with $4 billion owned and managed. We started diversifying a little bit in 2013 when Willis actually purchased a company that I had started back in 2003, which was an engine parts business. So ostensibly a vertical integration play. When our engines become unserviceable, we would disassemble them and sell the pieces. In 2016, we purchased a lot of the intellectual property from what was Total Engine Support, a consulting business. And that enabled us to work directly with TES's customers to provide lease engines when their engines were going into the shop. And then in 2018, we continued that diversification by getting into the airframe services and maintenance business in Teesside in the UK, where we've got base maintenance, line maintenance on narrow bodies, and an FBO. When I took over as CEO about a year ago, one of my first initiatives was to try to redefine how we present ourselves to the marketplace. And instead of being a leasing company with a few ancillaries, we started looking at ourselves really more as a three-legged stool. And that's Willis Lease, the leasing business, all the different services businesses, which include, you know, the 145 repair stations, engine MRO, airframe MRO, and our parts and consulting businesses. And then the third leg of the stool, which is what you touched on briefly, the innovation piece. That's kind of going back to what I've mentioned briefly earlier about us trying to look into the future and say, where is aviation and similar businesses, ancillary businesses, in a decarbonizing future? And how can we participate in those areas? What can we do in terms of leveraging our strengths to be able to add value to different businesses out there?
I talk to a lot of people at the moment who are looking to invest in sustainable aviation, it's quite hard to know who the winners are going to be. So how are you selecting which projects do you think are worth investing in?
It's a really good question, and it's a tough one. I had a conversation with the CEO of a major flag carrier, and I asked him sort of a similar question. I said, you know, you guys are trying to get involved in sustainability and in different avenues. How do you pick the winners? His view was, look, you know, it's too early at this stage to pick the winners. We don't really know what it's going to be. He was basically saying they're looking at trying to participate in a whole bunch of different things with the hope that, you know, that one of them will ultimately be, quote unquote, the winner. I tend to agree with him with one caveat. I think the winner is going to depend a little bit upon what specific segment you're talking about. So to paint aviation with a broad brush to say that there's going to be one solution for sustainability in aviation is probably not accurate from my perspective. I think the easiest way to look at it is to break it down by segment length. So, you know, if you're looking at sort of sub 300 nautical mile legs, then you're probably looking at something around electrification or electric aircraft. You get out to maybe sub 1,000 miles, and that might even be pushing the envelope. You start looking at hydrogen electric powertrains, so essentially producing green hydrogen to run through hydrogen fuel cells. And that gets you out, right now it's sub 1,000, but I think it's going to get to 1,000 at some point. And then beyond that, I think you're looking at SAF, at least for the foreseeable future. There's also some interesting developments in hybrid technology that may come online more quickly than others. So in my opinion, I think those are probably going to be the general areas that make the most sense to focus on for the foreseeable future. And it's really dependent upon capacity and stage length.
One of the controversies that I hear people talking about is whether aerospace equipment lessors should be investing in eVTOL. I don't think you've made any investments in that space. Well, what's your view on the role of eVTOL in the future?
You know, it's tough to say. I think before eVTOL, forgive the pun, takes off in a big way, I think you're going to see more traditional aircraft powered by electricity, by electric motors. So frankly, I haven't focused a great deal on eVTOL, but I would imagine new technology, even in conventional aircraft, will be proven in the short-haul freight market first.
Fantastic, and I can't wait to see how this develops. I'm hearing a lot of people talking about this, and a lot of lessors making a lot of noise about it, but what is Willis Lease actually prepared to do itself?
So for us, we're really exploring how and where we can add value. There's a lot of different places. I think on the hydrogen electric side, you know, with our maintenance capabilities over in Teesside in the UK, at some point we would like to, at a minimum, do some of the conversions for the aircraft as they convert them from traditional hydrocarbon burning turboprops into the hydrogen electric powertrains, because I think you're going to see that proceeding sort of clean sheet design aircraft, because it's just a simpler, faster way to market. And you're already seeing a lot of the hydrogen fuel cell companies doing preliminary flights for, I think it's Dash 8s and ATRs. So I think we can participate there. I think we can add value by helping to monetize the engines after they come off of the conversion. So we can both finance the conversion, and we can also help lease out, you know, the PW150s or PW127Ms as they come off of the airplanes. I think that's an interesting area for us. I think on the sustainable aviation fuel side of everything we discussed, that could be an interesting area for us. I think with SAF, we may be well placed on the distribution side, because we know the airlines, we know kind of the hot points, hot buttons. You know, we can work well to be a project developer there.
Can't wait to see it happen. Just talk about COVID crisis. For so many people in the industry, this was an existential threat. So firstly, how did your business survive more generally? And I guess secondly, were sustainability issues just put on hold for a couple of years?
I think yes. We've never seen anything like it. And I've been through a few downturns, 2001, 2007. Nothing was quite like this. You know, historically, our business has been fairly countercyclical in the sense that when airlines are facing difficult times, they'll look to the finance department to make decisions on whether or not to invest in overhauls. And more often than not, they'll, you know, remove engines that become unserviceable, park them, and lease in spares during recessions. And that gave us sort of a countercyclical edge. The pandemic was different. You know, when all of your customers go to zero revenue effectively overnight, nobody's flying. So, you know, it certainly impacted us. We did really an amazing job. And this is a testament to our entire company, the marketing department, finance, legal, of working with the customers. I know of a few different lessors that sort of took a hardline approach and essentially said, you know, you need to pay us, and started sending out letters to that effect. but we really became de facto partners with a lot of the airlines. And it came to restructuring agreements, working with them on timelines. And, you know, we took very few losses and write-downs. But that's basically how we got through the pandemic is just rolling our sleeves up, hard work, and working airline by airline to find solutions that helped keep them afloat, but also protected the underlying value of our assets.
Well, I'm sure that's paid off with long-term relationships. So just looking forwards now, to the extent you've not already covered it, is there anything you can say about your future strategy for the business generally and particularly for sustainability?
I think it's taking what we're doing and what we're looking at with sustainability and at the right time in the future, making investments. You look at sustainable aviation fuel as an example. There's a lot going on there that still needs to be sorted out before it can be scaled up materially. But we are seeing really positive advancements in certain areas, in particular, what's called a power to fuel or PTF. The historical problem that we've seen with SAF is it's been developed primarily with alcohol to jet fuel and HEFA, which is using fats and oils to produce the jet fuel. And they're both good, but they both have their limitations. Alcohol to jet fuel has certain policy constraints in Europe. The HEFA is great because it's fairly inexpensive to produce because it uses traditional refining equipment. So the CapEx is a bit lower, but the feedstock is becoming more and more scarce. So the reason I mention it is those two pathways are proven, but I think they've got limited future and scalability, or at least there's the potential for limited scalability, whereas the e-fuels that I'm talking about have potentially unlimited scalability. And it really hasn't been historically available because there hasn't been sufficient green electricity. Because basically what it is it's taking hydrogen combined with CO2 through a Fischer-Tropsch process to produce SAF. So that's got potentially unlimited scalability, but it's going to take an awful lot of green electricity. So anyway, I got a little off topic. That's a long-winded way of saying we're interested in the sector, but it's very much a moving target.
I think I said to you previously that it's sort of fascinating to speak to the chief executive of an aerospace leasing business that is quite so into the detail of some of the solutions that are going to be needed. I mean, I think as we move towards the end of this, we can afford to be a little more broad in our vision and aspiration. I mean, have you got a vision of the future for aviation and aerospace in a more sustainable world?
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of ties back to what I mentioned about having different solutions to different problems. I think it's going to be electrification. I think it's going to be hydrogen. I think it's going to be SAF. But I think the governments need to put their heads together and come to sort of a meeting of the minds with regard to policy and legislation, because until we have generally global consensus on that, or at least at a minimum, regional consensus, it's going to be really hard for people to develop projects to meet the sustainability goals that have been put forth over, you know, the next 25 years. As you may be aware, for project development to get financed, essentially it needs 90%+ likelihood that it's going to succeed. And if you've got any one element that falls short of that, whether it's a project on project risk, whether it's technical risk, or whether it's legislative risk, it's just not going to get financing.
Thanks, Austin. At the end of every podcast, we ask the speaker to pose a question to the next speaker. So our last speaker, Nicholas Lund from Rockton, his question was, who's going to pay for all of this?
It's a good question, and it's regionally dependent. So it's sort of a sticks and carrots question, right? If it's mandates, it's sticks. And that's really going to be shouldered by the consumers, because if you mandate an airline to fly with X% of SAF over a period of time, that's going to incur an additional cost. So the mandates are going to be shouldered by the consumer. And you're seeing that with currently contemplated legislation in the UK. And likely what they're going to do in Europe is going to be similar. When you look at tax incentives and grants, then that's ultimately going to be shouldered or burdened by the taxpayer. So I think it kind of depends. And then, you know, there is another third level as well, which is going to be the financial institutions, as you described. But it's hard to say, you know, whether they're ultimately going to pay for that.
Well, I can't wait to see some of your initiatives announced. So listen, we get to kind of wrap up now. We have a number of great speakers coming. I mean, what question would you pose to the next speaker as to, you know, what challenge do you make to the industry?
The question that I would really pose to the next person you have on is one that I've been trying to reconcile myself. And it's with some countries imposing mandates, some having incentives, some having nothing. How do we create a level playing field between airlines operating internationally? That's a question that I'd love to get answered.
Austin, that's all we've got time for today. Thank you so much for your time and for your insightful comments. To our audience, thank you very much for listening. We hope you found it interesting. Any questions or queries, please contact me directly if you like. My email address, paul.briggs@twobirds.com. You can find my details on our website. Please look out for the next episodes in this series coming, and please let me know if you would like to share your views. Thank you very much. Good day.